Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac-Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Jen is off once again, this time yelling at politicians in Sacramento. Filling in for them this week is the new media coordinator for MLB's Cut 4, Jessica Whitney. Jess, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, it's almost that time of year again. The second annual Players Weekend will take place from Friday, August 24th through Sunday, August 26th. This past week, players' jersey nicknames were announced, and there were some good ones. What are some of the best nicknames that players have picked out this year?
So I guess we have to hand it to Brad Boxberger for being the first person to manage to get emojis onto his jersey. He's going with a box emoji and a burger emoji. So it's just his name, which is not a nickname, but he's presenting his last name in an original creative way. So I'll give him that one.
Yeah, could they like all just use emojis?
Like, you know, like the Yankees definitely should with Didi's tweets.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, why is he the only one taking advantage of this? Why isn't everybody doing that? I don't understand.
Maybe next year he'll have started the trend and we'll see more players doing this.
Hopefully.
Yeah. And my second favorite is Joey Votto with In Flanders Fields. Again, it's not remotely a nickname, but it's just such a bizarre pick for him, and it really makes me love him. So to provide a little bit of context for this, In Flanders Fields is the title of a poem written by Canadian physician John McCrae during World War I. And it's kind of become a huge thing in Canada and other countries, particularly the Commonwealth countries. And it's repeated every year on Remembrance Day, which is November 11th. And it's kind of the reason why poppies are the symbol for that particular holiday.
So basically, Joey Votto is a big old nerd.
Yeah, pretty much.
Extremely Canadian.
That's great.
Maybe after he was just like, I don't care about Canadian baseball. He was just like, oh, like now I got to get like a real Canadian to make up for that.
Well, I think I think this is a good step in the right direction. I guess for me, if I were to start with anyone other than Rich Hill, I would just be being dishonest with myself and with all of you. I'm sure everyone is aware by now, but Rich Hill's Players Weekend jersey says D Mountain on it, and pretty much everyone immediately put together, oh, D, okay, his name is Rich, short for Richard, another nickname for Richard, Dick, he's Dick Mountain. And it's just like, I can't believe that he actually got away with that, and I also like kind of can't believe that he did that, but I am so happy that he did, because he's the best. Rich Hill is ridiculous, and he's a legend.
I have to agree. I think that's probably one of my favorite nicknames this season.
I also agree. That's great, and this podcast has endless love for Rich Hill, so this is just adding to that.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other one that kind of stood out to me this year was Tommy Hunter is a bigger fella, which of course only works in the context that there has to be a big fella, and that is Rhys Hoskins. But I appreciate that. I guess it's kind of like a Corey's brother type situation, I think it's better because they're actually on the same team, and like you like see both of them at the same time, and I think that one is one of my favorites this year.
I'm just sad that nobody went with the biggest fella on the team. Like, it's just missing that, like, one extra step.
Yeah, so, that was a missed chance.
Who would it have been?
Who is the biggest fella on the Phillies? That's a good question.
It's probably Tommy Hunter, but, I mean, they should have looked around.
It would have been great if the smallest guy on the team was biggest fella. Like, if they roped in Odubel or something, got him to do it.
He should have done it.
Yep. And now that you mentioned Corey Seager, he petitioned MLB, like his first choice last year, or Kyle Seager, was Corey's better. But MLB said, no way, you can't do that. So he went with Corey's brother. And then this year, he just went with Seager, which is...
Well, he is now the only Seager playing, so...
Yeah, he's officially outlasted all the others. Well, for the time being, at least. I still believe that we'll be seeing Corey Seager again at some point. I have not become that much of a baseball nihilist that I don't think that'll happen.
Yeah, I'm sure he's fine. I definitely am partial to Ferris for Walker Buehler. That's my favorite movie, so I freaked out when I saw that.
I love that so he doesn't shy away from it. I love that. Have you seen when he pitches at Dodger Stadium after strikeouts, they play the, oh, yeah, which that was terrible. I'll never do that again. But it always cracks me up when they do that.
And his Twitter handle is Buehler's Day Off, which, I mean, I love the embracing.
Leans into it.
Yes. I think my second favorite's probably Joey Gallo, but I don't, so his nickname's Pico de Gallo, but his last name's Gallo, but it's spelled the same as Gallo, so it looks, when you see it on the jersey, it looks great. I think it's hilarious.
Yeah, but that's a good one. On the flip side of things, were there any players who could have chosen a better nickname?
I mean, all the players that didn't choose a nickname. There are just a lot of straight-up last names who didn't even go with emojis to dictate their last names. And I feel like that's such a miss. It's a really fun weekend. It's kind of a great way for players to show off their personalities. And it's just really boring to kind of see all of these players just going with their last names. It would be fitting for if it were like a handful of players and we just know them as like, these are the boring guys, so they just went with their last names, of course they did, and like, and that in and of itself is kind of a thing, but I feel like too many players did that for it to like actually kind of be a thing.
There's only one player I'll excuse from not picking out a nickname, and that's Zach Greinke, because he's just an enigma. I mean, I don't even know what he would have gone with. And if he would have gone with something, I think it would have taken away from the fact that I'm terrified of speaking to him. So,
yeah, maybe he could have been Wilsey's dad, because his mom on Twitter, or his wife on Twitter, is Wilsey's mom. And Wilsey is their cat, which it always cracks me up because I'm like, you have a real kid now, and yet you're still identifying as your cat's mother. But that's like the only thing I can think of for Greinke. It would just kind of be too weird for me if he actually went with a nickname instead of just his name. Along the lines of someone just going with their name, I can't decide if it's really great or really just kind of weird and lame that Caleb Ferguson went with Caleb Ferguson, like the whole name. Like, I mean, it's kind of funny, but it's also like, what? That's not a nickname. That's like even less of a nickname than if it was just your last name.
It's like the exact opposite of a nickname, because it's his entire God-given name.
Yeah.
I'm honestly surprised Judge didn't go with a nickname this year. Kind of disappointing. And Mookie just did Mookie, which is like, I mean, right? Definitely like a nickname, but
like it's not his nickname anymore.
No. And it's like Buster Posey going with Buster. Like, cool. We get it. But I don't know, when you like identify these guys as their nicknames and their like official stats are under their nicknames, it's just, it seems less fun.
Yeah,
they use it for Players Weekend.
Yeah.
Maybe they just hate capitalism and they were like, we are not going to give people a reason to spend more money and to put more of their hard-earned dollars into this machine, you know? So it's kind of a protest on their part.
Oh, yeah, they're fighting the system. That's what's going on here.
One can help.
So in much more serious news, Dodgers closer Kenley Jansen will be out for at least a month after experiencing an irregular heartbeat in Denver. Prior to Thursday's series opener against the Rockies, Jansen was hospitalized before returning to Los Angeles on Friday to be further examined. He previously underwent surgery to correct an irregular heartbeat in 2012, but still has experienced issues in Colorado. In June of 2015, the high altitude triggered an increase in blood pressure for Jansen, though he was medically cleared to play in the series. Above all, we wish Kenley as speedy a recovery as possible. That said, what does his absence mean for the Dodgers and the NL West race as a whole?
Well, so far, it's meant that the bullpen has blown the previous two games since Kenley's left. And I mean, for one thing, it is Colorado, it is Coors Field, like that sort of thing happens. But also, you know, if you have a situation like the Dodgers had yesterday where they were winning 2-0 and they kind of had to turn to a hodgepodge of relievers to try and get through it and clearly did not succeed as opposed to being able to turn to Kenley Jansen, it's, you know, obviously that's not necessarily going to be what happens every single time. You're not going to have someone hit a 3-run home run to walk it off every single time. But it's obviously, like, the timing, I guess, is such that it feels very ominous. It's disturbing. You know, no team wants to lose their best reliever. That makes a big difference. It gives you so much less peace of mind at the end of games. And so I think if I'm, you know, either the D-backs or the Rockies, I'm not, you know, celebrating this by any means, obviously, but I'm secretly grateful for it because I think I understand that that means that the Dodgers just got considerably less formidable, and it's probably going to make this race even closer than it already was.
I agree. I mean, you can't have your starters, like especially a new kid like Walker Buehler, go 7 innings, no runs, and then, you know, have the bullpen just lose the game. It puts a lot more pressure on starters to go longer as the season, or the second half of the season is going. And I completely agree that it's going to just make this West race completely closer. Hopefully we'll see another, you know, don't jump in our pool from the Diamondbacks. But yeah, I completely agree with you.
Yeah, it's definitely tough for the Dodgers to, you know, make up this month plus loss of Kenley Jansen in any way. Hopefully it'll just be a month, and then he can return to the team, and we'll see a strong Dodgers team, you know, in the last 3 or so weeks of the season. Hopefully they'll still be you know, tight in this race, and it won't be the Rockies and the Diamondbacks kind of surging ahead. Because it's always more fun when there are more teams involved coming up to the wire.
It was a long time coming, but Felix Fernandez is officially moving from the rotation to the bullpen for the Mariners. King Felix is having his worst ever season with a 5.73 ERA and a not much better 5.03 FIP and a career low 17.9% strikeout rate. So what do you guys think has happened to him, and will we see him start again this season?
So I think it's kind of a lot of things that have happened for him. Obviously, he is reaching kind of the end point of his career, or the last several years of his career. And it's natural for pitchers to decline in this way. His sinker hasn't been sinking as much as it has in the past. And all of his pitches overall have undergone a velocity decrease, which is always difficult for pitchers to recover from. So I think it for him, it just depends on figuring out how to mix his pitches a little bit more so that his fastball can be more effective than it currently is. And so the velocity decrease won't matter as much.
Yeah, his command, I guess, is basically gone, pretty much. And it's weird because, you know, it's Felix. It's a dude who is known for having really pinpoint command. And it's, you know, obviously the residual effects of that are such that, you know, he is striking out fewer guys than ever before. And, you know, that's tough for a dude who you kind of associate with strikeouts. And obviously, you know, pitchers can adjust to a loss of stuff. That's something that can be done, has been done in the past by guys. I've seen career rejuvenations. But I'm not sure that if Felix is ever going to return to starting, it'll be this year. It just, you know, the Mariners have a deep enough rotation, I think. And if they do make it to the postseason, you know, they won't need five guys. So, it's hard to imagine Felix getting back in that situation too. So I think this may be it for Felix out of the rotation this year.
Yeah, I agree. I don't see them putting it back in. They already have five in the rotation, and who knows, he could be lights out from the bullpen. I don't see it happening. And maybe we'll never get another Mike Trout off
with
Felix home run.
It's a tragic thought. Although, we kind of, I mean, I don't know, how many guys have been homered off of both as a starter and in relief by the same guy?
That's true.
We'll get
Not
some
that
weird
I'm
stats.
Hoping this is going to happen exactly, but now I'm curious.
There's always something to look forward to.
Okay, so on Saturday, the San Francisco Giants retired Barry Bonds' number 25, the 12th number the team has retired. Bonds is the only player to have his number retired by the Giants without being in the Hall of Fame. He is inching closer to getting in, having received 56.4% of the ballots this past year. He has four more years on the ballot, and his percentage has increased each year that he's been on it, but still don't know for sure whether or not he is going to get in. So between being immortalized by the Giants in this way and his sort of rickety Hall of Fame potential, what do we think of Bonds' legacy?
He's obviously one of the most tremendous baseball players to ever play the game. And I think it's, in a baseball sense, it's good that the Giants retired his number without waiting for the Hall of Fame induction, because it's obviously very uncertain whether he will be inducted, and to do it kind of after he fails to get into the Hall of Fame would be kind of weird, I think. So it seems like it's a good time for it to have happened in that sense, and for the Giants to have honored his legacy with the team and in relation to baseball as a whole.
Yeah, I definitely think that it's kind of too wronged. We definitely, you could sit there and watch his home run highlights for an hour probably, and still not see all 700 plus. But on the other hand, when we post Barry Bonds stuff on social, our comments are all just like syringe emojis and, steroid comments. And it almost outweighs like the positive feedback that we get or, you know, normal replies that we get. And I didn't really expect that the first time I posted Barry Bonds content to our account. And not saying that the people that, you know, that interact with Cut4 are, the same people that are like, they don't represent the entirety of baseball fans. But as someone who grew up in Northern California, Bonds, like, is even still like a polarizing figure, and was kind of used, people who weren't Giants fans would, you know, throw that in Giants fans' face all the time, especially when he was playing and getting close to beating the record. And so I definitely think Yeah, I don't know. I agree. You can't deny that he is one of the best baseball players of all time. And I think, honestly, when we look back at it, if he ends up not getting into the Hall of Fame, I think that's always going to kind of stick out like a sore thumb. Because out of all the players from the steroid era, I think he is almost an exception to the rule. So, I don't know. I think he had a good quote yesterday, kind of just reminding us of how quote unquote big his head is. But they asked him about AT&T Park, and he said, "When I walk in here, I know whose house this is. So McCovey didn't play here. Willie Mays didn't play here. I played here. Like, this is my house. I built this house." And it's kind of, I mean, removed from his career now, kind of, it made me chuckle, but he's not wrong. I mean, the Giants almost went to Florida if they didn't sign on. So I think he's leaving a good legacy, at least in the Bay Area specifically.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting to sort of contrast the reception that he got, you know, with from the Giants and from Giants fans at his retirement ceremony, and how, I don't know, I guess the general baseball public tends to perceive him. Obviously, there's kind of been a push in recent years to, you know, recognize him for his achievements in spite of, you know, the steroid usage. And I mean, the fact of the matter is he was playing in a time when pretty much everyone was using steroids. And, you know, I don't mean to say everyone was, but, like, nonetheless, there were many, many players who had inflated stats because of steroids. And, you know, that's just the fact of the matter. There's, you know, complicating factors in every era of the game. And that just kind of was the one for the time in which he was playing. And, you know, obviously there's the argument that, well, that was cheating. It was something that was expressly forbidden, so, you know, that's different than, say, pitcher stats being improved because they were pitching off a higher mound. But nonetheless, that's just the era in which he played. It's an era in which nothing was done about it until much later, and it's just kind of what we have to live with now, you know. We can ignore that it happened all that we want. And, you know, by all accounts, the Hall of Fame probably will. It seems kind of unlikely that he'll jump up 20% in 4 years, but stranger things have happened, I suppose. But yeah, it's just interesting to sort of contrast how that perception and how, you know, the thought of him, you know, ruining the sanctity of the Hall if he were included versus how he was treated in his retirement ceremony and how everyone there is praising him as the best of all time. I'm not saying one is more right than the other necessarily, but I don't know. It's just always interesting to see how differently the same player can be perceived given the particular circumstances.
Yeah, it just seems particularly preposterous to leave the steroid era players out of the Hall of Fame now that Bud Selig is in the Hall of Fame, and he's the one that allowed all of this to happen, if not encouraged it to happen. So it just seems like there's, you know, a real big contradiction in terms of that strain of thinking that should be corrected, but probably will never be corrected. So, in case you didn't get your fill of us ranting about Joe Simpson last week, we have some good news for you. The Braves god broadcaster has dispensed some more nonsense on air. When the Braves were facing the Nationals on Tuesday, Simpson called the accuracy of rookie phenom Juan Soto's age into question, saying, "If he's 19, he certainly has his man growth. He is big and strong." This commentary provoked plenty of backlash. In an open letter to Simpson, the Dominican Prospect League requested that the broadcast recuse himself for one game, stating, "The inference you made on August 7th that Juan Soto is a cheater is not acceptable, should not be tolerated, and you should suffer some tangible consequences for the irresponsible use of your words on live television." Jeff Passan tweeted, age fraud hasn't been a thing in Latin America in nearly a decade. But then again, Joe Simpson is stuck in the past, so it's not a surprise that he proffers this sort of garbage. Ignore it. Juan Soto was 19, period. Full stop. And he's doing things the game has never seen before. So, what is actually wrong with Joe Simpson?
I mean, I think that Passan said it nicely, that he's living in the past. You know, I think when we ranted about his complaining about batting practice attire last week, we, you know, made it very clear that this is what happens when baseball broadcasting is dominated by a bunch of old dudes. It's like, yeah, you get dudes who've been around for a long time and have seen a lot of the game, but you also get dudes who don't necessarily evolve with the times, because that's just kind of how people are. They, you know, get used to things being a certain way, and they don't necessarily adjust well when things change. It's like the Grandpa Simpson thing about how, oh, I used to be with it, but then they changed what it was, and it'll happen to you. And, you know, I don't like to think that, you know, we'll all age quite as stodgily as Simpson has, but nonetheless, it does point to an issue with baseball broadcasting that I think we spoke on last week, and that's, it's a very overall old profession, and it just, you know, it has not, in many ways, many of the current broadcasters have not managed to adapt in a way that, you know, is sort of necessary to make the game appealing and to, you know, be able to handle stuff like this accurately. You know, as Passan said, and as the Dominican Prospect League said, you know, this is not a thing that happens anymore. And in Juan Soto's particular case, we know that he's not 19. Like, there's plenty of evidence to back it up. And Simpson, I guess, in addition to not adapting with the times, also just doesn't do his research and would rather make snarky comments based on old and accurate stereotypes than, you know, actually providing useful commentary. So yeah, I guess that's what's wrong with Joe Simpson.
Yeah, I don't know if he just kind of like looked around at the world and America and baseball today and decided to kind of like really lean into the fact that everything is bad. Or if we all just kind of notice these things more. I don't know if he said quite these same sort of comments in years past. But it just seems like it's really just kind of piling on at this point. And hopefully he doesn't try and like top these things as the season continues, because I'm not sure I want to know what he is capable of saying on air.
Yeah, he's kind of compounding his statements at this point, and I think they could only get worse. I don't agree with him, obviously, and I think the fact that, you know, we have, even past Joe Simpson specifically, like, we have Smoltz on these national broadcast games just complaining about baseball, and I don't necessarily always tune in for the commentary, but there's very specific games that I will, or teams that I'll watch, and when I do watch them, I do listen to the commentary because their announcers are very good at their jobs. And even yesterday, Brandon McCarthy tweeted, and I mean, obviously he's on the Braves, and Joe Simpson is talking about him and his team. He tweeted, you know, the perfect example is Joe Davis and Oral Hershiser, and like how excited they are about the team that they're covering and how positive they are about baseball as a game. And I think, I mean, I don't know how Twitter savvy Joe Simpson is, but hopefully he'll see that and kind of think twice. But I don't know. Something needs to be done. I definitely agree. Sounds like my grandpa's up there.
Yeah, and it's just unfortunate to know that he won't really get any sort of punishment for it. I think the moment sort of passed for that. Because, yeah, the fact of the matter is this isn't just him, you know, not evolving with the times. It's also him defaming a dude. And right. That's obviously not acceptable. And it's, you know, obviously he can get judged all that people want. Like, people can complain about him and, you know, we may think less of him. But the fact of the matter is, if he doesn't actually suffer any consequences for it, I don't really know what's gonna change. He's not on Twitter, as Chip Carey pointed out when all the Utley and Dodger nonsense was going on. But obviously word can still get to people if they're not on Twitter, but that nonetheless, it's him, you know, not being part of that sphere at all, I think sort of limits the impact that can have. I guess I'm pessimistic that he will actually learn anything from these experiences that he's had in the past couple of weeks. As my boyfriend noted, he managed to make a fool out of himself publicly over both the oldest hitter in MLB and the youngest hitter in MLB, which is kind of amazing. As for whether or not anything actually changes, it's anyone's guess. I think most of us would guess that it probably doesn't. But, you know, if he surprises us, then great. I would be a surprise. So we'll see.
On Friday, the Orioles lost to the Red Sox 19-12. This loss mathematically eliminated Baltimore from the AL East. The August 10th calendar date ties the 1962 Mets for earliest elimination ever. As Connor Ryan of MassLive News noted on Twitter, JD Martinez has more home runs than the Orioles have wins. As of recording today, Martinez has 37 home runs and the Orioles are 35-83. Will we remember the 2018 Baltimore Orioles as one of the worst ever teams?
I certainly hope so. First off, I think this kind of speaks to how great the Red Sox as a whole are. They swept the Orioles in a doubleheader yesterday and can go for the four-game series sweep today with Chris Sale returning to the mound. So certainly the Red Sox are a sensational team, but also it just speaks to, particularly in the American League, the total lack of parity amongst teams, and I hope that kind of gets sorted out in the next couple of years, and that the Baltimore Orioles represent kind of the lowest of this situation, particularly with how free agency has gone and how teams are kind of actively tanking. So I hope that is not a trend that continues. My fear is that the Orioles will inspire other teams to just totally kind of give up on seasons, from the onset, and that this will be a trend that we see for the next several years in baseball, and that would contribute in a large way to making Major League Baseball almost unwatchable. For me as a Red Sox fan, this season has obviously been great to watch, but also it just doesn't become fun when you enter a game and you just know that your team is going to win and it's not really going to be that competitive. It just makes for weird, boring baseball a lot of the time.
Yeah, it's not as fun when, it's not as competitive of a game. As nice as it is sometimes to have stress-free games, you're watching it because you don't know what's going to happen. You're watching it because you have no idea who's going to win. It definitely is not the spirit of the game to have a bunch of terrible teams and a bunch of really, really good teams. It's not really what you want to see, even if it is to the benefit of your team. As for whether or not we'll remember the Orioles as one of the worst teams of all time, they currently have a sub-300 winning percentage, that would put them in some fine, fine company. Since the 1962 Mets went 40-120, there have been not that many teams who've been that bad. There's the Detroit Tigers in 2003 who went 43-119. That was a .265 winning percentage. So the Orioles managed to only win 8 more games this season. They'll tie that. Kind of think they'll manage a little better than that, but you never know. I mean, if they are really going all in on the tanking, maybe they'll do worse than that. But that's kind of hard to actually see happening. Like, even really bad teams stumble into wins sometimes. It's, I don't know, what's kind of funny to me, though, is that with the 1962 Mets, like, that was before the draft was introduced, so you couldn't even be, like, tanking then for a good draft pick. You didn't, like, have that even as solace. Like, you were just bad, and it was just embarrassing. So at least with the Orioles, they'll always have the dignity of the number one draft pick next year, assuming that, you know, Kansas City doesn't somehow unseat them for that, which they could, actually. The Royals, now that I'm looking at it, are 35-81 right now, so that's a they only have a better winning percentage because they've played two fewer games. But yeah, so I don't know, maybe the Orioles will purposely be worse than the 2003 Tigers just for the sake of the draft pick.
Yeah, I don't even understand, like, the tanking for a draft pick thing, because MLB is, like, the one league that your draft pick doesn't bring you immediately, like, gratification next season. So you're tanking, you get this number one draft pick, and then you wait 6 years. And so in those 6 years, are you continuing to tank and waiting for your number one prospect from 6 years ago go up through the minor leagues, or do you hope he's good enough that he's up in 2 years? It's just kind of funny to me that it's this, like, long con, this of tanking from the Orioles.
Yeah, I guess.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's just, like, such a question of what would happen to the organization in those 6 years. I think baseball has kind of made it such that, organizations that are tanking can still be profitable. But at the same time, there was only 18,000 people for yesterday's first game against the Red Sox. And normally, in any other year, that stadium would have been packed for that game, and it was more than half empty, which should be concerning in terms of, you know, actually maintaining an active fan base. But who knows? Who knows what the Orioles will do? Who knows if they'll, you know, start to kind of follow the Tampa Bay route and slash payroll such that they can still make a profit off of a terrible team. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see what Baltimore does, you know, next season and in the next few seasons.
Yeah, I guess the other argument for tanking is that, you know, you're bolstering your farm system, you're hopefully getting some big name prospects in there, and then you can use that as trade bait. You can use it as, or you can use that to potentially bolster your major league team sooner rather than later. But I guess the flip side of that is usually teams like the Orioles are big time sellers, which, you know, we saw was definitely the case with them this year. So, you know, why are you stocking a farm system for a team that, you know, has been totally dismantled at the major league level? So, yeah, even that is not necessarily something that is going to prove to pay immediate dividends. Also on Friday of this week, Hayden Pinn of Atlanta's Class A affiliate, the Reno Braves, made history with a little help from Minor League Baseball's extra innings rule. Entering the game in the 10th inning, he required only two pitches to record three outs after the runner on second was doubled up on a lineout. The next hitter lined out to first base. According to Baseball Almanac, 182 pitchers since the stat was recorded in 1894 have thrown three pitch innings. This event was the second bizarre extra innings occurrence this week. On Monday, the Clearwater Threshers beat the Tampa Tarpons 1-0 despite not recording a hit or a walk. The runner on second to start extras for the Threshers advanced to third on an error by the shortstop and scored on fielder's choice to give the team the 1-0 victory. What were our thoughts about this rule before today, and have they changed at all due to these feats?
So I think before all of this I certainly thought that the starting the runner was kind of cheap, kind of bogus, like not in the spirit of baseball. However, I also thought that since minor league players are kind of so stiffed on how much they make for baseball, that it also kind of makes sense for them to speed up extra innings games and not make these poor guys play, you know, 13, 14, 15 plus innings, essentially for nothing. So I did like the rule before now in the minor leagues. I would not like it implemented in Major League Baseball, I think. And certainly it just kind of like adds a little bit of coolness with these two events happening that would never have been able to have happened before. So it's just a neat thing added to a role that I like for the minor leagues.
Yeah, I agree. These players don't need to be playing crazy extra inning games, especially. I mean, when you work in minor league baseball, also it's those games are the worst. I mean, you can't go home. They can't go home. There's no fans in the ballpark, and the game impacts absolutely nothing. So, yeah, I think prior to this happening, I definitely, you know, I wasn't a fan of it as a baseball fan, but as, you know, like the logic of it and these kids have to go get on an 11-hour bus ride as soon as this game's over, and it's just delaying that. And I think it makes sense logistically. However, I maybe they could implement a rule about you know, not doing this extra inning runner if there is like a record on the line. Like I'm sure this pitcher, although he did throw the no-hitter, it's kind of a shitty way to lose. So maybe they'll add an addendum to it.
Yeah, I mean, you obviously feel for someone who is pitching like the game of his life and, you know, ends up losing it on sort of weird technicality. I mean, you know, not quite Harvey Haddix's level here, but nonetheless, still gotta be a really painful experience. But yeah, I'm with both of you that if we can wrap things up more quickly for minor leaguers, there's no harm in that. You know, it's not like I don't think they gain anything by having to go out there and play all those extra innings and like really wear out the roster, you know, besides maybe getting experience for when that happens at the major league level. But also, I don't think that it's something that they really need to go through. So yeah, I think we all can agree that we don't want to see this happen in the majors where dudes are making like actual money, but at the minors where, you know, you have kind of these not great living circumstances, you know, anything to sort of make their job a little bit easier is not a bad idea. That said, are there any extra innings rules that we would like to see Major League Baseball implement?
I can't think of like a single specific rule, but I would really like to see Major League Baseball and teams embrace the weird baseball thing, particularly, you know, extra innings games that go past midnight in whatever time zone they're played in. I think the teams could really do some fun things with that, you know, within the stadium.
Yeah, weird baseball's always a fan favorite on Twitter, at least. And I don't know, I feel like it sort of, I don't know, it's sort of a unique thing that you don't really get from other sports so much. The vibe of a midnight game is very, very unique thing. And, you know, we've seen like dudes eating ice cream in the dugout, whether or not that was intentional or coincidental, I'm not 100% sure. But I don't know, more of that, I think, would definitely make things more fun.
Yeah, only have one rule implemented in my head, and it's half joke, but in response to all the shift complaints, maybe having one less fielder in the extra innings, and then a team can decide where that fielder is and how they want to realign their defensemen. But yeah, and then every every inning that you progress, you lose another fielder. So it's the ultimate weird baseball.
I love that. It's the 18th inning, and it's just a home run derby.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, you know, adding a runner obviously very much changes the game, but taking away players, like, that just adds like a level of chaos that I have to say, I would be curious to see that, like, try it out just to see how quickly games actually do wrap up as a result. But yeah, that's an interesting idea.
Thank you.
All right. So going from the future of Major League Baseball, let's throw it all the way back with this week in baseball history. On August 15th, 1916, Babe Ruth starts versus Walter Johnson and beats him 1-0 in 13 innings.
August 16th, 1920, Ray Chapman is hit in the head with a pitch and subsequently dies the next day from a fractured skull. This famously ushered in certain changes associated with the start of the live ball era.
On August 14th, 1971, Bob Gibson, at the age of 35, throws his first career no-hitter, striking out 10 and walking 3 against the Pirates, while also personally driving in 3 runs.
Pretty good start. On August 16th, 1996, the Padres and the Mets play the first ever MLB game on Mexican soil, with Mexico native Fernando Valenzuela on the mound for San Diego. It's a slugfest as the Mets win 15-10.
So we should definitely be playing more games in Mexico is what I'm getting from that.
Absolutely. More games everywhere outside yes. the continental United States.
Strong agree.
All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @sarahwexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. You can follow Jess on Twitter at @Jessica_Whitney. You can follow the absent Jen Jen Mac Ramos. And you can find the podcast at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from binsound.com. You can find all episodes of the Hardball Times on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.